Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of The Deep Dive, I'm joined by Cory Doctorow. Cory is a science fiction author, activist, and journalist. He's the author of many books, most recently The Bezel, which is a follow-up to Red Team Blues, and The Lost Cause, a solar punk science fiction novel of hope amidst the climate emergency. His most recent nonfiction book is The Internet Con, How to Seize the Means of Computation, a big tech disassembly manual. Other recent books include Red Team Blues, a science fiction crime thriller, Choke Point Capitalism, nonfiction about monopoly and creative labor markets, the Little Brothers series for young adults, In Real Life, a graphic novel, and the picture book Posey, The Monster Slayer. In 2020, he was inducted into the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Hall of Fame. This is the first time I could say that I have a Hall of Famer on The Deep Dive. So I want to welcome you to The Deep Dive. Cory, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you. It's nice to talk with you.
Thank you, my friend. We're going to spend most of our conversation on The Internet Con and The Bezel. But, you know, we're going to start with your two most recent books, The Internet Con, How to Seize the Means of Computation, and The Bezel. And I'm going to start the conversation with The Bezel. It's the one I actually finished most recently. Both are very fresh in my notes, but nonetheless, I want to use that as a way of sort of weaving in so many of the central ideas and concepts that seem to run through your work. You're quite prolific online as someone who tweets quite often, turns those into essays on your website, post on Medium. There's lots of places out there to get your work. And The Bezel seems to personify many of the themes that are important to you. So I want to give you an opportunity to start there and kind of walk me through a little bit, myself and the listeners, what was the inspiration behind creating this, the story of The Bezel?
Well, The Bezel is a novel in a series I'm writing, the Martin Hench books. Red Team Blues was the first of these. And in turn, those two books, as well as several others, are part of a collection of 9 books I wrote during lockdown. So for better or for worse, the way that I deal with stress is by writing. And so during lockdown, I just climbed into the hammock in the backyard and just wrote and wrote and wrote. And so the first Martin Hench book, it had a kind of curious conceit. The idea was to write the final volume of a long-running beloved series about a kind of rapscallion private eye type who's a forensic accountant who busts finance scams in Silicon Valley. And to write that final volume as though it were the last volume in a series that the audience might have been following for decades and, you know, sort of fall in love with this character. And finally, this is his last adventure, one, you know, getting called out of retirement for one last big job, but not bothering to write any of the other books. And so just, you know, like a bit like it would be kind of weird and fun if there was a TV show that was just like the final episode of a long running series without bothering with the series, like the last episode of MASH without the 11 seasons before it. There's something about that final episode that's got a kind of energy that I really like. And my editor really liked it too. And he bought 3 in the series, which presented a problem because, you know, I had written the final adventure of this beloved character and really had fallen in love with him while I did it. And, you know, his story is that he spent 40 years in Silicon Valley busting every kind of finance scam, and he's seen it all, which makes him a really fun character to write. He's very knowledgeable, has a lot of tradecraft and so on. And he's a noir hero. You know, the noir detective is an unlicensed cop who's, you know, asking the questions the cop can't ask and going the places the cops can't go and therefore solving the crimes the cop can't solve. But of course, the thing that makes it noir is by the end of every one of these adventures, he has to realize, oh, these are actually questions the cops wouldn't ask, places the cops wouldn't go, and crimes the cops didn't want to solve. Marty's kind of an unlicensed IRS inspector who's solving the finance crimes that nobody wants to solve. And, you know, I think of this in some ways as being kind of Panama Papers fanfic. If you've read the Panama Papers, the IRS files or what have you, you find that although there's a lot of technical complexity in how these scams work, that complexity, it's ornamental. Like, there's a lot of this complexity that is just there to befuddle the person who's encountering it. And that, you know, it doesn't take a lot of doing to figure out that this is a scam, which leaves you with this conclusion that, you know, the reason the IRS is letting the worst people in the world, you know, take billions of dollars, trillions of dollars out of the world's economy and hide it in treasure islands around the world and then repatriate it through things like real estate investment trusts and other vehicles is because they don't care that they're doing it. They don't want them to stop. And so that's Marty's own realization. So when my editor asked for two more of these books, kind of moped about it a little. You know, there's precedent for bringing a detective out of retirement. Very famously, Arthur Conan Doyle brought back Sherlock over Rickenbacker Falls, but that was because Queen Victoria offered him a knighthood. And, you know, my editor's a very powerful man in New York publishing. He's vice president of the Macmillan Company, but he doesn't get to knight me if I please him. And so
that's not pending.
It's not pending. Yeah. I'm not going to be Sir Corey anytime soon. I realized that there was another way to go with this, that since Marty is kind of the Zelig of high-tech finance crime, you know, his kind of backstory is that he's been everywhere and he's done everything. I could write these books in any order. I could write them in backwards order. And, you know, moreover, that when you write books in backwards order, you don't have any continuity problems because you don't have to foreshadow, you get to backshadow, right? Everything that you put in makes you look really premeditated, even if you're just winging it. And so that was how I came to write The Bezel. So the Red Team Blues is set in the mid-2020s, right around now, and it's a cryptocurrency heist, which is very fitting as a final adventure because there is nothing
absolutely
scammier that, you know, tech has done than cryptocurrency. As we record this, Sam Bankman-Fried has just today been sentenced to 25 years in prison.
25 years.
His lawyers were seeking six. He stole billions of dollars. They called it a victimless crime. You know, it was really quite an amazing
business as usual.
Business as usual. Well, Madoff was unambitious, clearly. And so this is set in a different era, and it's set in an era that embodies this idea of the bezel. So bezel, the word here is not B-E-Z-E-L, that black rectangle around your phone screen. It's B-E-Z-Z-L-E, like embezzle. And it's a term that John Kenneth Galbraith came up to describe what he calls the magic interval after the con artist has your money, but before you know it's a con, in which everyone feels better off, right? That moment where, like, you think you're rich and the con artist thinks he's rich, but the only one who's rich is the con artist. But so long as you never, like, ask the con artist for your money back, you know, you can go on feeling rich. This was kind of Sam Bankman-Fried's defense. He said, like, look, I know I gambled away all that money that people gave me, but if you let me keep betting, I'll eventually get it all back. I didn't really steal their money. It's just temporarily unavailable, right? And the only reason they feel poor is you know, bullies and law enforcement made me admit that the money wasn't there.
You stopped the merry-go-round, right?
Yeah. And so the bezel here is this magic interval between the dot-com crash and the great financial crisis. And it was a period where a whole lot of money started sloshing around thanks to a combination of very famously collateralized debt obligations and all the shenanigans in the housing market, but also just gigantic amounts of global capital being flushed into the stock market. In particular, billions and billions of dollars were laundered from the treasury of the Saudi royal family into a company called Yahoo by a venture capital fund called SoftBank. And SoftBank, even if you've never heard of them, you've definitely encountered some of their later bezels, things like WeWork, Uber. You know, they're real masters of the con here, real like kind of artists, you might say. And, you know, during that period, a lot of us felt better off. But of course, that was destined to come to an end. You know, Stein's law says anything that can't go on forever eventually stops. And so it was definitely the case that someday the merry-go-round was going to stop on this. And so this is set mostly in that period. And it's about this lovable rogue, this Martin Hench guy, who has a best pal who has sold a company to Yahoo, as so many bright people did. And Yahoo proceeds to do what it's done with every one of its acquisitions, which is to just destroy it. And the way that they destroy these startups, it's quite ingenious. They have all of these minor princelings, and they make their compensation contingent on building empires within Yahoo. And so those minor princelings just try to destroy the things that their rivals are trying to make a success in order to make their own company successful. So that's what this guy called Scott is contending with. And, you know, in order to kind of avoid as much of this as possible while he waits for his stock to vest and for himself to become kind of financially independent and able to go off and do another startup, he does what a lot of nerds might do. He kind of hacks the system. He reads California employment law. He reads his contract. He realizes that he's entitled to so much paid leave between, you know, holidays and sick leave and, you know, weekends and vacation that he basically can take a 4-day weekend almost every day, almost every week. And he discovers the pleasures of a place called Catalina Island, this real place that's really quite remarkable. It's an island that at one point was the birthplace of the CIA. It's the place where Marilyn Monroe did a turn as a child bride. It's where old man Wrigley, who owned the Wrigley chewing gum fortune, brought his baseball team, the Chicago Cubs. You know, the reason the Chicago Cubs play on Wrigley Field is that Wrigley owned them. He brings them there for their spring training every year. Dow Chemicals at one point drops 50,000 barrels of DDT into the channel between the island and Long Beach. It's the deepest channel known to humanity. Those barrels are not made to last at that depth. And, you know, there's no way to bring them up again. So enjoy the condors and other birds downstream of them while you can, because they're all doomed. There's nothing we can do about it. It's just they're write-offs. So there's been lots of strange and wonderful and terrible things happen on Catalina Island. And today it's kind of a pleasure island. There's some townies, but mostly there's a lot of tourists who come out. And that's who Scott falls in with. He falls in with this group of real estate weirdos who he quite likes in a kind of strange way. And the reason he likes them is because, unlike tech weirdos, they just want to take their money and go off and party. They don't want to talk about work all the time. So unlike, you know, the people at Yahoo whose company he's trying to avoid, these guys, you know, you can go to their parties, take some blow. They're
a little more pleasant to be around.
Yeah. Or at the very least, they're not as exhausting to be around. And it is in this group's company that Scott and Marty find themselves in the middle of another bezel, a Ponzi scheme. See, old man Wrigley, who, you know, founded the island and created its rules, and, you know, the island's actually run by a trust that Wrigley set up. He thought that fast food was de class A. And so he decided there would be no fast food restaurants on the island. And, you know, whatever. I'm not a big fast food fan. But what it did was it created a forbidden fruit effect, where people on the island really love their fast food burgers, you know, partly because they only get them very rarely. And this becomes the basis for a Ponzi scheme, where people are smuggling fast food burgers onto the island and then flash freezing them and then selling, as Ponzi schemes do, as pyramid schemes do, selling the right to sell the burgers. And they realize that this guy has actually set himself up to destroy the island's economy for no reason other than that he can. And so they plan a controlled demolition of this, and they actually blow up the Ponzi scheme and save the island's economy. But that becomes the beginning.
And chaos ensues.
Yeah, right? That's the beginning.
I don't want to give it away.
Well, I'll just say that for complicated reasons, this ends up to Marty's friend pleading guilty to a couple of felonies at a time when California has a 3-strikes rule, where if you get convicted of 3 felonies, you go to prison for the rest of your life. And then, wouldn't you know it, he ends up pleading guilty to a 3rd felony. And that is where the tale of woe begins. And a vast corrupt empire of prison technology becomes the center of Marty's attention.
And this is what was really interesting to me, is that there's a lot of cascading effects that only matter to the extent that you are engaged with them. And what I mean by that is that, you know, not many people think about 3-strike law, right? That was, you know, prevalent throughout the 90s and the 2000s, when everybody, liberals included, were hard on crime, right? We were going to take back the streets. Sounds very familiar to the times we're in now, to the point where the character Scott, he kind of had a 2nd felony which he didn't think too much about because it was like, eh, what do I care, right? And then you kind of get lined up with the third. I think it's safe to assume this was one of these folks who probably didn't spend a lot of time worrying about the jurisprudence of the state of California until they're roiled up in it, right? So I want to use that, because I feel like that's woven throughout the story, right? Like even Marty didn't think about the labyrinth-like ways in which prisons operated until he had a friend there, right? And then it becomes an all-consuming mission to understand the injustice of it all.
And well, you know, William Gibson says the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed. And, you know, one of the people who for whom the future is very lumpy is prisoners, where a lot of the future is pooling up around them, specifically the worst parts of the future. All the things that are going to get done to people of more agency than prisoners at some time in the future are being done to prisoners today. And so if you want a little preview of your future, you can just look at what's happening to prisoners and you can get a pretty good sense of where you're headed.
But few people want to look at prisons for a variety of reasons, right? Part of it is that we live in a society that is largely punitive, right? Like the more we can punish, the better it is. So even among the liberal set, you know, and I'm using the word liberal very specifically, there's not that much concern for prisoners, right?
Yeah.
So I want to use that to kind of talk about this concept of the bezel, right? Like I want to tease that out a little bit more because, like you said, it's that space, that magical space between when you've been scammed and your realization of being mm-hmm. scammed. Mm-hmm. And a metaphor for, you know, a lot of business, but being who I am, it kind of seemed like a metaphor for the way this country works, right? Like, aren't we all in some sort of bezel? Whether
if you're convinced that the source of your misery, just to take one example at random here, if you're convinced the source of your misery is migrants who've taken your job and you allow yourself to be sort of talked into voting for xenophobic authoritarian policies, you will find before you know it that in fact the same people who convinced you of that are now using those authoritarian policies to come after you, right? That is a bezel that I think a lot of working people are themselves living through right now as they're convinced to be the turkeys who vote for Christmas.
And is there... I love that. I love that one, right? And, you know, there's also the bezel of higher education, right? Or meritocracy.
Sure.
Because as I'm reading this book, I'm thinking about some of the language that's being thrown around today, right? Like folks are, you know, I unfortunately still do spend time on Twitter, right? I'm being sarcastic. I don't mind spending time there. And, you know, as of the time that we're recording this, there's all this conversation around DEI, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like, didn't earn it, right? It's like the term that folks are throwing around. And I think about the incredible entitlement and ignorance of people who have this position. And I feel like on some level, taking aside their ignorance, they believe in the meritocracy, right? Like they believe that if they just do these things, it's all going to work out. And when it doesn't work out, it's some shadowy Black person who took their job, right?
Well, like, and you know, that's a much easier belief to get along with than the belief that the reason things that were good happened for your dad or for you or for someone else that matters to you is that they got lucky, right? That's a tough one, you know. And there are lots of memes about this, you know, where the boomer who says, "Well, in my day, you know, we didn't worry about our college debt; we just paid it off and got on with it." And then you realize that, you know, inflation adjusted, they were paying like 18 cents a semester for college, and earning you know $75 an hour. Again, inflation adjusted, and you ask, well, how was it that these people were able to be so fiscally prudent? So, yeah, I think that you know, it's much easier to say I did well because I have some intrinsic virtue than it is to say that I did well because I was in the right place at the right time. have worked in the tech sector in one capacity or another. Mostly for the last quarter of a century, I've worked in digital human rights with a nonprofit called the Electronic Frontier Foundation. But, you know, I also helped found a startup and I worked in tech. And oftentimes people will say like, well, what advice do you have for young people who want to get jobs in tech? And my joking response is, well, look, if you don't have the gumption, the foresight, and the work ethic to be born in 1971, I can't help you. Right, because being born in 1971, you know, I had an Apple II Plus in 1979. I got on bulletin boards as they were just getting started. I dropped out, I went to university and it wasn't for me, but it only cost like a couple of grand a semester. And then I dropped out and there were more jobs for people who understood even the smallest amount about the web than there were people who could fill those jobs. And so, yeah, you know, of course, it wasn't that merely that I worked hard, I did. And it wasn't merely that I had some innate talent or passion for the subject, I did. But it was also that I just got unbelievably lucky, just an absolute accident of birth.
Well, we can't structure a society based on luck, right? So, sure. So given that reality, and I'm not disagreeing with it, right? A lot of opportunity is a function of timing. If you are at a certain place in time, things just sort of are breaking your way, right? Like, I think it's silly for anyone to think that the job market that someone like myself faced in 1994 and again in 1999 is not the job market that people are facing today.
Yeah, right? Sure. And, you know, if you want to see people who are really like being messed up by this, go to the UK. I lived in London for 13 years. And, you know, the UK, like lots of places, is a place that just stopped building housing, even as the number of people who needed a place to live went up. And as a result, anyone who had the foresight to live somewhere is now a millionaire. And there are tons of British people who think that they are the Louis Pasteur of real estate speculation, like veritable Warren Buffetts, because they had the incredible plan of living in a place. And they look at all these people who are incapable of finding a place to live, and they're like, well, look at how well I did, right? Why don't you exhibit the same foresight and planning that I have and get a place to live?
Yeah, which is, I mean, I've spent a lot of time in the UK. I have family there. And, yeah. You know, you go to a place like Bath, you know, where I was this past summer for a little while. They ain't building no new shit in Bath. Like, no. You know, no. it literally looks like something out of like, if hobbits existed and they had a town, that town would be Bath.
Yes.
Right? Like,
yes,
they're not adding no new cottages on those little streets. Right. Yeah. So if you think you're going to go there and speculate wildly on real estate, good luck. Right. But all of those things, this sort of luck that we're talking about, this culture, you know, I use the term meritocracy, but, you know, exceptionalism is a term that comes up quite often in your work, in your essays. A lot of that seems to me so much built into not just tech exceptionalism, but sort of an American exceptionalism that makes all of this, again, feel so much like a bezel to me, right? And I think maybe it's because I'm as a Black person, you know, you can see that we have cameras on, right? You don't buy into a lot of this stuff, right? Like, I feel like I grew up being skeptical of this shit.
Although, right? I, you know, far be it for me to tell you how Black people talk about the Black experience. One thing I've heard Black people—
We do have meetings, though, regularly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yes, indeed. Yeah. One thing I've heard a lot of Black people talk about is Black people who do well and then insist that other Black people who are struggling have a victim complex. You know, this is sort of the Clarence Thomas problem.
Oh, yeah, but we voted him out of the meetings a long time ago.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, just I think that, like, there is this sense that if you happen to get lucky, you think that you're representative as opposed to fortunate. Nobody wants to attribute their, you know, their position in life to a roll of the dice. They all want to, you know, lay claim to some, you know, some virtue that produced this incredible outcome for them.
Yeah. And there is some agency, right? Like, I'm not suggesting that there isn't, but I think, again, as I look out on these stories, you know, and like you said, you spend so much time cataloging the tech industry and the particular, it has a particular hubris that—
Yes, it sure does, yeah.
—that I find to be fascinating because it couches itself in this kind of savior perspective.
And a hyper-rationalism.
Yeah, yeah. And when you pull away, you start to peel away the layers, you're like, well, this is just the same bullshit, right? And so yeah. So when you were kind of talking about these bezels and that period, you know, after the dot-com boom and into the great financial collapse of 2008, you know, I was a Wall Street kid and I kind of was, that was something that I was very interested in growing up. And I remember even before I was on Wall Street, there was like the savings and loan scandal, right? Like there was the junk bond scandal. Like it was these huge bubbles. Everybody blew them up and then people picked through the bones and came out on the other end with more money.
Yeah. Yeah. Bubbles of increasing intensity, right? We kept, as the saying goes, doing the same thing over and over again and hoping for a different outcome. And, you know, as you say, the people who failed up, who created a bubble and then got very wealthy, you know, thinking of people like even like Neil Bush, right? You know, gets to grow up and continue to be part of this great political dynasty. A brother becomes president and so on. These people, you know, had no reason to ever, you know, sit back and have a reckoning with themselves and ask themselves, you know, did I do anything wrong? For them, they could just, in the same way that you could take credit for all of your good fortune, you could absolve yourself of culpability for all the bad fortune. You know, it's a very handy way to go through life. It certainly is a way to stay a lot happier, provided that you don't have to live with the consequences, provided those consequences are just being externalized to other people.
And, you know, I started this a little bit talking about the punitive nature of the United States, right? Or prison cultures, whatever, however you want to classify that. But when you talk about the repercussions of things, yeah, there's an occasional, you know, like we talked about Bankman-Fried, who got sentenced today, and, you know, Bernie Madoff. But by and large, if you look at these structures systemically, there are no real ramifications to incredible theft and fraud and malfeasance. And I would make the argument that in some cases, the public, as punitive that they are, seem not to have the same sort of bloodlust for those who commit these sorts of crimes. I was just going to say, like Trump and Clinton, and Hillary Clinton, when they were debating famously, and she tried to bang him on the, oh, you don't even pay your fair share,
that
Donald.
Makes me smart.
And he was like, I don't give a shit, right?
Yeah, that makes me smart. That's what he said. It makes me smart. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think a lot of people agree with that.
Well, you know? Sure. I think that, so there's a phrase I've been turning over in my head a lot. I encountered it in Naomi Klein's new book, Doppelganger, which is a very difficult book to describe, but a very, very good book. And it's a phrase that turns out to have been in use for a couple hundred years. And it's that anti-Semitism is the socialism of fools, right? So if socialism is a kind of ideology or a kind of system of belief that tries to explain the systemic forces that produce certain phenomena we see in the world, anti-Semitism, rather than thinking about those as systemic forces, thinks about them as like individual schemes, right? That there's just like, there's a bunch of people who look like Weimar era, you know, anti-Semitic caricatures in Davos, like individually deciding to take all your money, right? It's not a system. It's not a, you know, these are not complex phenomena. They're simple phenomena. And you know, the implication here is you get rid of those people and everything is fine, right? So it's a very simple doctrine and in some ways, a very comforting one, right? Because if the problem is just, you know, that like there's some bad people in Davos, then you get rid of the bad people in Davos and then everything is fine. And you know,
the globalist.
Your issue is resolved.
The pesky globalists.
And so I think that, The right has always benefited from the fact that telling a story about individuals whose individual, you know, cupidity are behind the woes that other people face is a much more it's a much easier story to tell. It can feel kind of satisfying to tell that story, and certainly it like takes you to a much easier place, right? The okay, well, we just go do something about these bad guys. Show up at Comet, you know, whatever it's called, Comet Pizza or Ping Pong Pizza, whatever that place is called, with your AR-15 and demand that they show you the kids in the basement, and like, you know, job done, right? There's a famous interview where Noam Chomsky is on a, you know, big mainstream broadcast news magazine program, talking about the way that the news media are part of how consent is manufactured. And the reporter is interviewing and really bridles at this and says, look, Noam, nobody tells me what to say. And he says, no, nobody has to tell you what to say. If you were the kind of person who said the kinds of things they didn't want you to say, you wouldn't be sitting where you are, right? So that's the difference. And, you know, this comes up a lot when we talk about race and systemic racism and distinguishing between, you know, individual actions and systems. And so the right, you know, they play politics on easy mode, because they get to just say, well, it's the globalists, it's the bad guys, it's, you know, we are basically like, this is Batman, and you know, the bad guys are bad guys for reasons that only the bad guys can fathom. And, you know, it is the job of the all good people to defend the Bruce Waynes of the world, who are going to stop the bad guys from being bad. And if you're on one side or you're on the other, and if you get on the right side, then you will know that everything you do is going to help with the cause of making the world a better place for all of us. And so, you know, that's a really simple doctrine, and it doesn't require that you spend a lot of time thinking about how it works, or, you know, where it comes from, or why it might fail. You just got your marching orders, right? And, you know, stamp out systemic racism. Well, how the hell do I stamp out systemic racism, right? Do I have to do a lot of introspection? What do I do with that introspection? What if I introspect and I realize, oh, I did some stuff that I'm now embarrassed about? Now what? Right? Like, what, how, now, like, when do I get to punch racism? I just want to punch racism, right? I don't want to like struggle with it. I just want to punch it. And I want to punch it so hard that it stops. And then I can get on with my life. Cause, you know, I got better things to do than worry about racism. I want to, like, go see a movie and fall in love and raise my kids and do all that other stuff.
The people who want to punch racism the most are those who suffer from it.
I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that's true.
Like, I've been looking to punch racism for years.
I wrote a novella in my 2019 collection, Radicalized, about Superman happening upon effectively Freddie Gray's murder, although I don't name him, it's fictionalized, and intervening and discovering that he is, in fact, like, not automatically a hero of the American people, and that the difference between being like a superhero who's come to this country to help us and being a quote unquote illegal immigrant who's you know, doesn't respect our boys in blue is basically one instance in which you take the wrong side of that fight. The story is called
basically the Lex Luthor argument, right? Like,
yeah,
for those who are Superman readers, like, Lex Luthor actually detests Superman because he views him as this alien, right? Like, which he is, but he's like, he's holding human beings back. Like, if we rely on Superman, we won't ever get to be who we're supposed to be, the best of ourselves, right? That's not the Gene Hackman Superman of old, dating myself there. But, you know, this gets us a little bit to the internet con, and where you spend some time at the beginning of that book talking about the power of epistemology and the different ways in which we think, right? It made me reflect on that a little bit. And I'm curious your thoughts. Do we, and I'm using the public common good we, do we have the proper background or training to recognize some of these systems that are happening around us? Like you said, everybody wants to, well, not everybody, but, you know, maybe you want to punch racism, but you can't, like, do we have the capability of even grappling with these systems, right? You know, again, my personal editorial, I see a educational system that's been on the decline, right? Like, people just don't have the capacity to be critical thinkers anymore, or they wouldn't fall so easily into these kind of traps, right? That's one person's opinion. Maybe that's a trap in and of itself, right? That, you know, people out here thinking they have some sort of supreme truth, right? Where I would argue we just need to ask better questions. But what are your thoughts around these notions of our capability to grapple with the epistemologies that are running in the background?
Well, you know, this the passage you're describing is in the context of trying to understand the rise of conspiratorial belief, mm-hmm. right? And I think conspiratorial belief is like an epistemological failure, right? So most of us are not qualified. In fact, I would say rather none of us are qualified to assess all of the epistemological questions we have to resolve, right?
So absolutely.
Like, you know, am I safe eating the food I bought at the grocery store? You know, should I trust their food hygiene standards? Am I safe, getting in my car? Is the anti-lock brake software, adequately written? I live under the flight path of Burbank Airport. So, Southwest Airlines flies a lot of Boeing 737 MAXs over my head, like three while we've been talking, right? Should I be worried?
Yes, you should be worried. You might want to put a dome over your head.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, you know, the FAA tells me it's safe, but it's not. But, you know, that we're
there. And this is hacks.
This is the crux. Yeah. So this is the crux, is that we can't ourselves assess those claims. Right. Even if we can assess some of those claims. Right. I can't assess all of them. It's just too many. They're too technically complicated. Like, I'm not a dumb guy. I could go to school and probably become an aerospace engineer, but then like that still wouldn't tell me anything about, you know, the reinforced steel joists over my head in this garage I'm talking to you from that I turn into my home office, and whether, you know, the ceiling's going to fall in, right? Like those are all questions that have to be resolved by delegating my trust to institutions. And as you say, the institutions are run by hacks. The institutions are failing us. And so I think this produces a kind of epistemological chaos where it becomes impossible to trust at face value the claims being made by our institutions. And yet you need to formulate opinions as a matter of life or death about numerous questions every day. And so you're left with falling back on kind of conspiratorial accounts, especially, and this is a failure mode of liberalism, is that liberalism tends to, just like conservatism, tends to fall back on something that anthropologists call schismogenesis, which is when you define yourself by like what the people you disagree with believe. And you say, I disagree with what the people who disagree with me say. And you know, the right does this too. And so as the right starts to say, oh, we can't trust our institutions, liberals in particular, leftists less so, say, oh no, the institutions are great, right? When you are nuts to say that you don't trust vaccines because you think pharma companies are run by evil billionaires who don't care if they kill you so long as they make a buck. The pharma companies are really forthright and they just want to help you. And by the way, their regulators are fucking awesome, right? Like it's just not true. Now, like I'm vaccinated, right? But like I also, at one point, because I have a chronic pain problem, at one point I went to the doctor back when I was living in London. I went to a Harley Street quack because my wife had quite good insurance through her employer. And I asked about pain relief. And the doctor said, hey, you know, I got great news for you. It turns out that opioids are so much safer than we ever thought. And I'm going to prescribe them for you. You can just take them for the rest of your life and you'll never get addicted.
It's a bad idea.
And I was an opioid denier. Right. I went off and I did my own research in order to figure out whether I should be taking opioids. Now, like we look at the internet, which is allowing people with disfavored views to find each other. And we conclude that the internet is the source of those views. Like we have a story about radicalization that says that like people are just like innocently stumbling along, believing reasonable things. And then they encounter something unreasonable and they believe that instead. And I think it's far safer to say that people are stumbling around not knowing what to believe because the basis on which they believe things has been proven to be insufficient and dangerous to their health. And so they are now looking for anything else to believe. And what the internet does is it helps people find those people who are traumatized and looking for something to believe in and talk to them. And that's a force for good when it's people who have good political conversations that are substantive and weighty and get them to think about systemic issues. And it's bad when it's demagogues who say it's, you know, globalists and Davos who've done it to you.
And that brings me back to the tech determinism question, right? Because I feel like I said at the beginning, like skeptic or cynic or whatever, but I feel like when you embody certain experiences, your survival depends on your skepticism, right? So I've never viewed cops as like the neighborhood friend, right? Like that's never been in existence for me, right? So when people are surprised at things that law enforcement does that's shady, I'm like, well, how are you surprised at this, right? Like, and you mentioned this in the book, like the FBI is the enemy. Like you murdered civil rights leaders and Black Panthers, right? Like I will never, ever trust or respect the FBI, right? Because I saw Eyes on the Prize when I was 14 years old.
Sure.
Right? So that has insulated me from any belief in those institutions.
Just read the letter that they sent to MLK urging him to kill himself, right? If you have any doubt about this at all, right? It's a short letter. It's a banger. You're never going to think the same way. You're never going to feel the same way about G-Man again.
And so that kind of circles us back. Like if these things are not taught or known or better understood, it's harder for us to kind of build trust in maybe like each other, right? Like I'm seeking other institutional pathways that don't involve like this liberal conservative divide, which I find flimsy.
Well, right? allow me to invite you to consider the much more substantive leftist conservative divide, which I think is quite a good substantive meaty one.
Depends on the leftist.
It does. But I think, you know, I've spent a lot of time, this is a bit of a side piece, but I mean, the work that I do is very left informed. And there are a couple of definitions of leftism that I find really useful. So one, it comes from my friend Stephen Bruce, who's quite a good fantasy writer. And he is characteristic of leftist fantasy writers because his novels have the correct ratio of vassals to lords, rather. You know, it's not like a Hobbiton with a couple of decorative servants at the edge, right? It's just like endless fields of toiling peasants and one lord in the middle of it. They're quite good. And Steve says the definition of left and right hasn't changed since the French Revolution. To make the distinction, you ask someone, what's more important, human rights or property rights? And if they say property rights are a human right, then they're on the right. And if they say property rights are an instrument that we can use to achieve human rights, but shouldn't get in the way of human rights, then they're on the left. I think it's a really good litmus test. I actually think it gets you somewhere. It's a distinction with a difference. And then the other one is Corey Robin, who says that the thing that unites all kinds of right-wing thought, you know, Christian dominionists, racists, Hindu nationalists, libertarians, whatever, is the belief that some people were put on earth to be in charge of other people, and that the world is best when the people who deserve to be in charge are running things, and that when it's otherwise, right? This is back to your DEI thing. When it's otherwise, then everybody suffers because the wrong people are trying to direct things and they are not qualified to direct things. And so everything starts to fall apart. And, you know, I think that that's really good because it tells you how to take your intuition that there's something in common between, say, Mike Pence and the Koch brothers, even though like the Koch brothers, as far as I can tell, are atheists. And Mike Pence, as far as I can tell, like the single most important thing in his life is a kind of religious fanaticism. It's that they both believe that someone was put on earth to be in charge of other people. They disagree about who it is, right? But they agree on that.
But then we're kind of debating like hierarchy, right? Like we're trying, like I'm drilling it down, but I'm, you know, when I hear those things, like property in and of itself, right? Like if we're starting with that, I'm still like spidey senses going off, right? Because you can't own land, right? Like you can the way we structured this, but not really, right?
Well, so this will fall into the
ocean if we let it,
right? Well, but this is the right left divide. So if you're on the right and someone says, "Hey, you own this land, but we need to bring these fire hoses through it in order to keep your neighbor's house from burning down," you are within your rights to say, "I'm sorry, go fuck yourself. It's my land." Right. If you are on the left, you might say, OK, look, giving people rights to land, like think about the land reform movements of Central America that led to the dirty wars and all those coups, right? Where they were giving peasants ownership rights in land, both individual and collective, in order to insulate them from sort of these oligarchic cruelties and precarity, right? You say, look, we are going to create a system of property rights for the purpose of enhancing human rights. But if those human rights are ever compromised by the property rights, we'll just jettison the property right, right? The property right is there to serve a purpose, right? But say, you know, it turns out that the one mineral that we need to make the vaccine that stops the pandemic is on your land. And you say, sorry, that's my land. We're just going to say, no, it's not. Right now that's our land again, right? Because your property rights are there to enhance human rights, and where human rights and the property rights come into conflict, the property right is the thing that gives way. I think actually this is a really useful way of understanding political systems more broadly, is you don't ask whether one feature of a political system is present or another. You ask what happens when they come into conflict. So, you know, Yanis Varoufakis has been talking about our economic system these days as being feudalist. And what he means by feudalism is rent-based rather than profit-based. So, you know, rents are the incomes that you get from owning something, and profits are the income that you get from investing capital in productive enterprises. And his point isn't that there aren't capitalists today. His point is that the capitalists, when they come into conflict with the rentiers, lose. And so, you know, that's the important thing, right? Apple makes phones. Phones are, you know, in some like intellectual sense, useful. They are a product that we use, right? And then there's like patent trolls who trick the US Patent and Trademark Office into registering patents for dumb things like clicking on a screen or tapping on a screen. And they don't make anything. They just make lawsuits.
Or doing that thing. I'm doing like the expanding your finger action, right?
Pinch zoom. Yeah. Yeah. So they don't make a thing, right? All they make is a lawsuit. They register a business in the Eastern District of Texas, where the courts are most friendly to patent trolls. And they go there and they take hundreds of millions of dollars out of the hides of Apple and other productive companies who are doing productive things. So they are rentiers. They own a thing. That ownership is in no way limited by their ability to make a thing anyone wants to use. Right? They make money whether Apple wins, whether Samsung wins, whether Google wins, because they're just getting rent no matter who wins. They don't care. They don't care if anyone makes a thing that anyone likes. All they care about is that they have a property right. Where they come into conflict with Apple, they routinely win. And so Varoufakis's claim from this is that the reason you could say that we're not living in capitalism anymore is not because there aren't capitalists. You know, obviously Apple is doing something capitalist when it makes the iPhone, but when the capitalist enterprise of Apple conflicts with the rentier enterprise of a patent troll, the patent troll reliably wins. And that means it's not capitalism anymore.
And, you know, pulling that apart a little bit more, because, you know, you discuss that, you know, kind of understanding these systems, and we're discussing them largely in a tech framework, right? But you make the argument that there are very serious issues going on in the world, and we've named a few of them, right? We've talked about racism, we've talked about climate, well, we might have mentioned climate, but there's very serious existential crisis to the extent that one is concerned about human beings' survival, right?
Right.
And understanding and pulling apart these systems as it pertains to the technology that we use seems to be central to making this better, mm-hmm. right? It's not going to solve it all, but if we can see how it's working through that domain, we can make adjustments in others. And I underline that in my notes because is, in your view, is some of that underlining the idea of tech's importance in our hierarchy, so to speak, or are there other ways of organizing, of solutioning that doesn't predominate a tech way through?
So I think there are two ways in which tech is exceptional that relate to these existential questions. Mm-hmm. And the first one you kind of hinted at, which is that, you know, I think of tech as the terrain on which these other fights will be fought. Right. It's anyone who's ever tried to organize protests or any kind of political mass movement without the benefit of digital tools, I don't think you can really appreciate just how easy tech makes it and how hard it is without tech, because it's still hard with tech.
Yeah.
But comparatively speaking, oh my God, you know, like that, just the, until you've ridden a bicycle around town all night with a, you know, a bucket of wheat paste and a bunch of flyers to get people out to a demonstration, you just don't know how hard it is to mobilize people and how much just like the hashtag makes a difference. You know, it's,
I mean, back in the day, there was the mimeograph machine, right?
Yeah.
You kind of do this.
It's very, very hard to overstate how game-changing it is to have digital technology in your life as a political organizer of any kind. And so all of these fights we're going to have, the fights about gender and race, climate justice, and so on, to say nothing of just the coordinative activity we're going to have to engage in, right? Like, you know, the, thinking about things like coordinating the global climate response. It's, you know, the only way we're going to do that is if we have good communications tools, a free, fair, and open internet. And, you know, unless we can have that, we lose the fight before it's even started. And so in that regard, tech is exceptional. It's the thing we have to, it's the thing we have to win in order to win the other fights. It's not more important, but it's like the infrastructure of those fights. Now, there's another way in tech in which tech is exceptional, because there are lots of industries where, you know, I guess we call it late stage capitalism has kind of been shitified them and made them, you know, like not fit for human thriving. But tech has these distinct technical characteristics. And those technical characteristics boil down to stuff that's hard to talk about without a little computer science jargon. The only computer that we really know how to make is something called the Turing Complete Universal von Neumann machine. And that's a lot of word salad that basically boils down to the only computer we know how to make is a computer that can run every program that we know how to write. So yeah. If it's a valid program, it'll run on a computer, right? So that is a very cool and interesting thing that has a lot of implications that take a little doing to get your head around. But foundationally, it means that if you are locked into some kind of silo, you know, say you're stuck on Facebook and the only way that, you know, you can communicate with those people who matter to you is through, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's good offices, it will always be possible for you or someone who cares about you to write a program that allows you to continue to talk to those people who are on Facebook without yourself having to be a Facebook user. And so an example of this would be how Facebook dealt with MySpace. So when Facebook was getting, you know, off the ground, everybody who wanted social media already had an account on MySpace. MySpace, absolutely. Famously, you know, owned by Rupert Murdoch, not a guy who's
glittery. Glittery yeah. pages.
And yeah, the animated
your top
GIFs.
Eight friends. Yeah.
Yeah, all that good stuff. Tom.
Happier time.
So, you know, owned by Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch, not a guy who's like famous for wanting to share. And
terrible
and
human.
So, yeah, really shitty guy. And so here you are. You're on, you want to use Facebook. Facebook actually had a great pitch, right? They were like, hey, I know you're using MySpace, but you know, Facebook is like MySpace, except that we will never, ever spy on you. It's the surveillance-free alternative to Facebook. It's the thing a lot of people forget, that this was what Facebook was pitching users on in 2006. And so what Facebook pitched those users was not just, hey, why don't you leave MySpace, come and use Facebook, and just like hang out and read our superior privacy policy until your dumb friends wise up and join you here. What they gave those users was a bot. And if you gave that bot your MySpace login and password, it would go to MySpace several times a day and pretend to be you. It would log in as you. And it would take any messages that your friends had left for you, anything they'd posted for public consumption, anything like waiting for you there, and it would put it in your inbox on Facebook. And then you could reply to it on Facebook and it would push it back out to MySpace. So this is like interoperability at its root, right? It's a way that you can break down the pre-feast menu that Rupert Murdoch had, right? Where it's like, if you want your friends, you have to let the evil, crapulent, senescent Australian billionaire spy on you, right? And you get to turn that into an a la carte menu. You get to say like, how about I'm going to take my friends, but not the surveillance. Right now, you could do that to Facebook today, except that the law that has grown up since then, largely at the behest of Facebook and other tech giants, has made that illegal. And not just a little illegal, very, very illegal, like 5-year prison sentence, $500,000 fine for a first offense for daring to do to Facebook what Facebook did to MySpace. And so, you know, I'm not saying that we get a better capitalism. Well, I am saying we get a better capitalism. I'm not saying we solve the problems of capitalism by making better regulations on the tech companies. But I am saying that we could get a better capitalism, right? That we could get, we have to ask ourselves, was there a time when capitalism gave us a better internet? And I think the answer is unequivocally yes, that the internet has gotten monotonically worse in the last decade or so with monopolism. And then we can say, okay, well, all of our other things that we want to do, fighting to, you know, for a habitable planet and racial justice and gender justice and so on, are only possible to the extent that we have a free, fair, and open internet. That's the necessary but insufficient precondition. So what can we do to restore that free, fair, and open internet, to build a new good internet that is a worthy successor to the old good internet and corrects its failings? You know, for example, the fact that it was mostly hospitable to techie people like me and not normies. What can we do to correct its failings but deliver an internet that is worthy of being the digital nervous system of a 21st century where we are trying to liberate humankind?
And to that end, right, you mentioned tech monopolies, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was famously Sherman antitrust law, right?
1890,
seminal, right? Very deep cut. Is there anything like that on the horizon that, and I'm going to bring up that word trust again, right? That we would trust the current types of administrations that we have in power to even put on the table? Because I'm a novice at this, and I proudly call myself tech reluctant, right? Like, I am never the first adapter at anything. I was blown away when a friend told me about rechargeable batteries the other day, right? Like, I'm still putting them in the freezer thinking that they will recharge because I'm 8. and I was born in the 70s.
Right.
So that's me, right? But when I read through things as someone who tries to stay fairly self-informed, everyone, whether they are Democrat or Republican, I'm only speaking about American context here, they're terrible at this. They do not understand anything, much less technology. They barely understand business. Which leads me to believe that I don't see another Sherman antitrust law coming that could adequately describe and do what you just said, right? Which is create a better internet that can help be a part of solving these existential crises. But maybe I don't know, right? So help me.
Yeah. So I think that, I disagree.
go for it. I love
it. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. So first of all, the Sherman Antitrust Act itself and its successor legislation, there's Robertson Patman, there's the Federal Trade Commission Act, and there's the Clayton Act, along with a couple other minor pieces of legislation on the way. There's sort of three major pieces of antitrust legislation on the books in the U.S., and then a handful of minor pieces of legislation. They're actually all pretty good. The problem isn't that they're like not fit for purpose in the 21st century. The problem is that we just stopped enforcing them in the Reagan years. Well, really, we stopped in the Carter years, but Reagan kind of, like, if Carter pulled out a couple of Jenga blocks, you know, Reagan pulled them out by the fistful. And then every administration since has done the same. And, you know, administrations do not have to be technical experts or rather governments don't have to be technical experts to make good technical policy. I think that's a fallacy. So if you look at, you know, like our water policy, in general, what we do is we defer to expert agencies to tell us how to treat our water, right? So there aren't any water chemists in Congress, as far as I know. But, you know, we can drink our water. And the reason we can drink our water is because there's a process that is not corrupted, right? Corruption's a huge problem, right? Like, there's places where you can't drink the water, but not because stupider people were providing expertise, right? It wasn't that Flint lacked for someone who understood how water worked. Flint just decided not to listen to that person. So the idea that, like, you have to have Congress people who are water chemists in order to not die of, like, cholera is clearly wrong. You know, I am here not dead of cholera, and I prove it thus, you know, because there's no water chemists in Congress. So we could have good tech policy. The reason we don't have good tech policy is because we have monopolies that step in and distort our policy debate. So take like the question of net neutrality, which, you know, it's a jargony term. Your listeners may not know exactly what it means. So in a nutshell, net neutrality is the idea that if you ask for some data from your internet service provider, their job should be delivering that data as efficiently and reliably as possible. And so, like, imagine you get in a, like we have you know, taxi cab neutrality. If you get in a taxi, and you say, take me to Joe's Pizza, and they say, well, you know, we'll take you to Domino's right away, but if you want to go to Joe's, we're going to circle the block a couple of times, right? You understand that that's like not a good taxi company. And if
their New York taxi drivers.
yeah. But if they've taken a bribe from Domino's, right? Yeah. Or if you say to your ISP, I want to watch some Netflix. And they're like, well, except we're Comcast, we're owned by NBC Universal. So Netflix costs extra. Yeah, you got to watch Peacock, right? We understand that, like, you're not buying your internet service to get the data that the shareholders of the ISP wish you could have. You're getting internet service to get the data that you want. And that it's just like, it's not a good service otherwise. And because of the ways that these systems work, in general, you don't have a lot of choice about ISPs. It's two or fewer in most places. And so, you know, market forces struggle to the extent that, you know, even if you believe in market forces, they really struggle to make this work. And so in general, like, the common sense case for net neutrality is, like, really easy to make. And yet, you know, we often don't have net neutrality. The FTC has struggled to, or FCC rather, struggled to make a net neutrality rule. And the reason for that is that when the FCC says, right, we're an expert agency, we're going to seek comment so that we can evaluate that comment with our expert hats on and find out what we should do. All the comments from big ISPs with, like, millions of customers come from, like, four companies, because it's basically a series of regional monopolies. You know, all the different companies have, like, divided up the U.S. like the Pope dividing up the New World. And so, you know, the everyone who's got 20 million customers is one of these monopolists who hates net neutrality. And they all show up with, you know, evidence in hand to say, oh, net neutrality is impossible. And so net neutrality consistently loses in these processes. It's not because you don't have good experts. It's not because you don't have expertise. It's not because it's hard to understand what the right policy should be. It's not because, you know, the people involved are too old to understand it. It's corruption, right? And the corruption comes from the fact that there's a small number of companies in the sector. And when there's a small number of companies in the sector, they find it really easy to agree on a set of talking points for Congress or their lawmakers. And then they can stick to that message discipline, and they don't have what sometimes gets called wasteful competition. So they have lots of profits, and they can spend that money getting what they want. And so that's why we get bad policy, right? It's not, you know, I think it's quite nihilistic to say that the reason things are bad is because, you know, Congress is stupid.
Well, corruption is its own stupidity, no?
Sure, corruption is its own stupidity. Absolutely, corruption is its own stupidity.
Especially when we recognize it, right? Which I think brings us back to the bezel, right?
That sure.
We're looking, like, everything you've just described is, I think people feel that, right? Like, they understand that they're blocked from something that should seem to be both common sense and also in the public's welfare, because the people that are involved in all of this are corrupt.
Yeah, right? But you know, this was also the case when the Sherman Act was first invoked. So the Sherman Act was actually passed 20 years before it was really used in earnest. Passed in 1890, but it was used to break up the Standard Oil Company in 1910.
And there were lots of men with top hats and monocles, right?
Men with top hats, monocles, tailcoats, you know, the whole Dickensian schmear. Yeah. And, you know, the people who did that, they weren't smarter than us. They weren't suffering under a regime worse than ours, or better than ours, rather. They didn't have a less of a challenge than we do. They were not, you know, using some forgotten art, like, you know, embalming pharaohs or something, right? Like, we know what they did, right? We know how they overcame their challenges. And there were a bunch of, like, kind of interesting and cool historic contingencies. So, you know, for example, like a big part of what gathered the political energy to get rid of John D. Rockefeller and his Standard Oil empire was this one woman who published a muckraking series in Collier's Magazine, which is a very popular magazine at the time. Her name was Ida Tarbell.
It was like a Reader's Digest of its time.
Yeah. Yeah. And her name was Ida Tarbell. She was quite remarkable. She was the first woman in America to get an undergraduate science degree. She had a biology degree. And her dad was a Pennsylvania oilman who'd been ruined by Rockefeller. And she had a grudge. And she painstakingly researched how the Rockefeller empire cheated. And she serialized in Collier's a two-volume book called The History of the Standard Oil Company, Parts 1 and 2. This was before they invented good titles. And it was so powerful. It was so convincing that it created the political will to break up the Standard Oil Company. I mean, it's quite an amazing story.
I mean, and I think those stories are Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, you know, the Triangle Waste Fire. You know, there's these moments in time that I think are crystallized opportunities. You know, I would say, you know, we've had these movements and they are usually a combination of the arts, something that comes from a person that takes a popular zeitgeist moment and galvanizes people.
Yeah.
And I think that's why work like yours is so important, right? Because it's in fiction and nonfiction. And that's why I wanted to have the conversation about these two books, because I feel like they support each other in a way, right? Like, one's fictional, one's not, but there's something that weaves through this language that can make you feel this process, whether we talked about corruption, you use the term enshittification. I think that's another, like, everyone feels these things, right? And now you look for answers and ways to organize around them in order to break through. You know, we're running on time, so I want to get to the drop before we go. But I had another question before we do that around switching cost, right? Because that's part of these sort of barricades, right? People feel this cost to switching, and the seamlessness of switching that you talk about makes it easier, right? Like, if people feel like they're not getting a good service and they can go to another service, they go ahead and do that, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of these internet companies have made the cost of switching high, right? Yeah. And so I wondered about that a little bit. Is it the cost that we're thinking about, is it truly a high cost, like a financial cost, or is it a psychological cost, right? Like, I haven't been on Facebook in any substantial way in years, and I don't miss it, right? So my cost is that this is like a shuttered sort of cobweb space that I just don't really interact with anymore because I don't care. And I wonder, can we break through some of these by sort of getting away from them, period, right? Like, take away their power by not participating.
So I agree that the goal should be to get away from these platforms that are run by people who are so manifestly unfit, and that we should have an eye to how we get away from them. But I would caution you against being too blithe about saying that the cost is low. I mean, it might be low for you, and it was low for me.
I don't think it's low. I'm trying to get a sense of, is it a financial cost? Is it a psychological cost?
Well, like, so let me give you an example.
How are we measuring the cost so we can get a better handle on it?
Think about why all the people that you know who still have Facebook accounts can't leave, like what it is that keeps them there. And I'll give you some examples of what we know keeps people on Facebook. So one of the things that keeps people on Facebook is that they are part of some sort of diasporic population. So they've left their home country, and the way that they stay in touch with the people back home is that way. Now, sometimes that's just like, oh, I went away to school. And sometimes it's like, oh, I'm a refugee, right? Either one of those is kind of a big deal, obviously. The refugee one's a little more of a big deal. There's people who have a rare disease who found themselves in a community of other people who share that disease. And so for them, it's really important. You know, we at the Electronic Frontier Foundation helped along a group of women who were breast cancer previvors. So this means that they have the gene for breast cancer. And so they're, you know, grappling with some pretty heady questions, like whether to have a preventative mastectomy. But they're also, because these are genetic disorders, right, they're dealing with family members, women in their family who died, right, because of breast cancer. So they're trying to, you know, kind of cope with that mourning and loss, and they're really important to one another. And then there's the people who they're because that's where their customers are. Right. So, you know, you run a small business and it's how you're the other people who are, you know, in your business stay in touch with you. That's a pretty big one, right? Obviously. Then there's the people who are there because, you know, their kid's little league team organizes its carpools there.
Yep. And there's a lot of that.
There's that matters to you too. Now,
yeah,
here's the interesting thing. Maybe like you can convince one of those groups of people that it's just not worth it, right? That you should all be headed out. But can you convince all of them? And more to the point, given that they are all enmeshed in communities that themselves have their own reason to be there, right? That are themselves like enmeshed in these same complicated systems, can they convince all of their people to go? This is something economists call the collective action problem, right? It's just that the cost of getting everyone that what economists call cost. So this is not a monetary cost. It's just like the amount of effort you have to expend in order to get everyone to agree is so high that it might not ever happen. And so you're just kind of glued to the platform. It's a kind of mutual hostage taking. And, you know, we are wise not to be too blithe about saying that this hostage taking is just sort of a matter of personal responsibility, and you know, other people can figure this out, and you know, whatever, right? Like it's important to recognize that this is something that really is, it matters, and it bites hard on the people it bites on. Even if it's not biting on you, it's biting on someone else, and it's biting really hard.
It's very much like when people talk about climate crisis and the amount of obviously pollution and fuel that we use to fly, and they're like, we should fly less. And I'm like, easy for you to say if your family isn't from here though, right? Yeah. Like if your family's from someplace else, like, or several places else, like mine is, you need those flights, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah. I was just listening to my friend Adam Conover talking about climate change on his podcast this morning. And, you know, he was talking with a climate expert and he said, look, I'm a stand-up comedian. Right? Like not flying, it means changing careers, right? It's just like, much as I know that maybe that this is not the right thing to do, I can't build a national system of trains, right? Like no one can, not even Elon Musk.
Yeah, he'll be back to that scene in Almost Famous when they start flying and the plane almost goes down and they go back to the bus.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like there are people who are stand-up comedians who don't have to worry about this stuff. They live in Europe and they take bullet trains, or they live in China and they take bullet trains, or they live in Japan and they take bullet trains, yeah. Right? They're like, these are solvable problems. They're just not solvable through individual action. And this is another really important point I want to make sure we hit on here, which is that, you know, the neoliberal minds app is in part about convincing you that the only way to think of solving problems is as an individual, right? You solve your problems by you yourself personally doing something about it. You vote with your wallet. And, you know, the vote with your wallet election is rigged. And it always gets won by the monopoly party because the people who have the thickest wallets get the most votes. And it's the only way to win the election is to vote with your ballot, right? To be a political actor, to not think of yourself as like an ambulatory wallet, but think of yourself as someone who has agency in the world and whose agency stems from collective political action.
Absolutely. That's why we're going to bring back those mimeograph machines. That smell was intoxicating when I was 6 years old. Literally. Yeah,
I grew up in leftist print shops, so I've got printer's ink and also solvents in my bones and also
there
in
you
my
go.
Brain tissues.
It worked for the Panthers for a while. Then them cops came. but nonetheless, I want to get us to the drop in the time that we have left. And the drop is anything at all that we could recommend to our users. I will say this about going through the bezel. I feel like there were so many little tiny drops in there. Like I wrote so many different books that the characters were reading that I now want to check out. So
it's the definitely a book about books.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of little drops in there. My drop is actually not a book. It's a show that I've been watching when I just kind of need to take a decompress from the world. And it's called The Reluctant Traveler. It's on Apple TV. It's just a fun show with Eugene Levy kind of playing the, you know, traveling mensch, you know, upset and scared about everything, but yet kind of getting pulled into these unusual situations in very beautiful locations. And it's low stakes, is on Apple TV, and it's just, it gets my travel bug going. I can't afford to travel like that dude does because I don't got a show following me around paying for everything. But nonetheless, it's good to watch at, to look at visually. And he's funny and it's just a cool little show. And it's called The Reluctant Traveler, and that's on Apple TV. And that's my drop.
And I don't know if I approve of you recommending things by Canadians. They are the worst.
We love Canadians. Some of my favorite bands are Canadians.
Canadians are like serial killers. We're everywhere.
Arcade Fire. Like everyone
else. Arcade Fire. There you go. That always come up. Yeah. Leonard Cohen.
Leonard Cohen. Yeah. Another one.
Yeah. It's this is actually a Canadian sport, is naming famous Canadians that people think are Americans.
Alanis Morissette.
Alanis Morissette. There's a great bit that Howie Mandel, another Canadian, does about growing up Jewish and Canadian and having his parents like point at the TV periodically and say, you know, he's Jewish, or, you know, she's Canadian. And then later on in life, pointing at the TV and going, that person is either Jewish or Canadian. It's one or the other. I'm proud of them somehow, either way.
Either way.
Yeah. I guess I'll recommend Stephen Brust, who I mentioned before, that leftist science fiction or fantasy writer. He's quite a dashing fella. He writes these like sword and sorcery, super fun, popcorny novels that have such a sting in the tail. And he started writing these books when I was 13. He's a good 10 years older than me. He started writing them in 1984. The first one came out, and he planned 20 of them. And book 18 just arrived in the mail. I'm reviewing it.
Oh, awesome.
And I had dinner with him a couple of months ago in Minneapolis, where he lives. And apparently book 21 is done and book 19 is done. And so there's just one more book to write. And it's a bit of a high stakes game because I love Steve. He's an old pal of mine, but he is an incorrigible chain smoker. And I am like, I don't want my friend Steve to die. Sure. I really don't want him to die without finishing this fucking series. And I think the more people who read it and are sitting there clapping their hands and saying they believe in Tinkerbell, the more likely it is that Steve is going to finish this goddamn series. It's so good. I can't even explain to you how funny and how witty and how imaginative and how erudite and how high speed and fast paced it is. Like, it is just a superb book, or series rather. And the first one
is awesome.
Is called Jereg, and it's unspellable. J-H-E-R-E-G.
It's in my notes.
Jereg. And so go and get Jereg. There's an omnibus edition with the first three from Random House, who own the rights to the first six books. And then the rest of them came from Macmillan, from Tor, which is my publisher. Boy, it's like one of those things where you start reading them and it's like being 11 years old again and discovering a new favorite writer and just like and learning that they have like 50 books you can just go nuts on. That's basically awesome. What discovering Steve's books is like. Will thank me.
I had a pre-drop. I didn't even know you were going to say that. And I literally have Jereg written down. I have the information. I have Liars and Outliers.
Also like a good book. Bruce Schneier. He's one of the good ones.
Yeah, those are the three that I have written down that I'm like, oh, I'm gonna check those out when I get a when I get a chance. So
you could do a lot worse than to read old Bruce. He's
like mine, my guy. Friend. You know, Corey, I want to thank you for taking the time, working with me, coordinating this East Coast, West Coast, all that good stuff, and coming on the show. Again, we talked about the Bezel, we talked about the Internet Con, but your work is expansive. I invite folks to engage with you through all the different ways in which you post your blog on Twitter, wherever they find you. Corey's been a pleasure, and I want to thank you for coming on a deep dive with me.
Well, the pleasure was mutual. Thank you so much.
Cheers, my friend.
You can listen to The Deep Dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @farflungphil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.